I do appreciate your attendance with us this morning. I am thankful for your willingness to be here. You know, some Sunday mornings it can seem as if though it's a little bit more of a task to be here for worship for various reasons, but we know that it cannot be compared to the task of God sending his son for us. And that fact alone should give us the ability to want and desire to be here, to worship God with just a portion of our time. So we're glad that we're here, and I'm glad especially for those of you who may not be feeling well and are still here. I appreciate your encouragement, as you do encourage me in doing that. There are few subjects that are as problematic as that of hell. For many years, many have wondered if hell really exists. Some suggest that perhaps it is just a myth that's been passed down from generation to generation in the hopes of scaring people into religion and a higher sense of morality and even belief in God. It becomes then this idea that is rooted in folklore almost, right? It was developed somewhere in some time, and that's really all that it is. It's certainly a hot-button issue when we consider that there's often divisions among people both in the world at large and also in the religious world. I mean, nobody can ever really agree on hell. And that has to ask us, is it really true that there is such a thing or such a place as hell? According to research done by the folks at Pew Research Center in 2014, 72% of American adults surveyed in that particular research believe in heaven, but that number drops to 58% when you ask them about a belief in hell. And that's kind of going to be reflected on all polls. It doesn't matter which one of who you ask, and actually, if you go over to Europe, that's going to drop even more drastically down to a percent that is probably lower than 30. But generally speaking, most people tend to believe more in a reality of heaven. Not all people do. You see that in that 72% number. But most people, or more people, tend to believe in a place that there is comfort, there is glory, there is safety. And the fact that we feel that way about heaven, I think, should give us an indication that something is put within us, something is within our spirits and our souls, that we crave good, we desire satisfaction, we desire glory, as opposed to that of the idea of hell. It's not easy to swallow the thought of a place where things are absolutely painful. It is absolutely suffering. There is this place of eternal pain. It's tumultuous. It's dark. It's miserable. And I would suggest to you that we don't incline our thoughts. We don't feel a desire towards hell because we weren't made that way. In fact, I would even argue that the idea of a hell for human beings should come as unnatural. And we're going to talk about that as to the reason to that. But I want to pose two questions that are going to solve our problem about the reality of hell this morning. It should. And I hopefully will answer that based on the Bible and some of the things that we'll be talking about. But we want to begin by asking the question just flat out. Is hell real or is it just a myth? In order to find out whether or not something is true, valid, or real, generally what we need to do is what we do in our system of court, right? Court of law. We need to examine the evidence and the details contained within. And so the more evidence we have, the less likely it becomes that hell is a myth or some imaginary place. And we mentioned earlier that it is easier to swallow the thought of a place where everything is great, which is heaven, right? Because the Bible tells us plainly that we were created with eternity in mind. Ecclesiastes 3:11 says, God has set eternity in the heart of man. We were created with the natural inclinations to desire such things. We long for heaven because we were created by the God of heaven. He left an imprint on his creation, and the greatest creation of all, that is man, that we should desire him and desire all that is good. And God is the embodiment of everything that is great and wonderful and absolutely perfect. But on the other side of that spectrum, it's harder to swallow the thought of some place where there's never-ending suffering, pain, destruction, death. And the reason we have a hard time swallowing this is because it's unnatural. It doesn't come to us right off the bat. We don't wake up in the morning and say, you know what, I think I want to go to hell today. That does not come natural to any human being. And if it does, something is mentally wrong. The Bible does not teach that, and we should never condone that kind of a mentality. We were not created with the desire for a place called hell. And to me, that's the key to the reality of hell, right? In the beginning, the Bible tells us that everything was good. Everything was just as God intended it to be. In Genesis 1 and 2, you're going to read the phrase over and over again. Everything that God made, behold, it was good. And he will sum that up and say, it was very good. It's perfect. It was free from anything wrong or bad. But the moment sin entered the world, and it did in Genesis chapter 3, what was previously good and natural was now changed and reversed to that which is unnatural. I want to read for you a passage from Romans chapter 1 that shows us this idea. We live in a culture and a society that does not call sin for what it is. Sin is considered to be a popular thing. Sin, if you don't do it, you're missing out. But I want you to hear what the Bible has to say about sin in Romans 1 verse 26. For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions. Notice the descriptions that Paul will use to describe the ugliness of sin. Degrading passions. For their women exchanged a natural function for that which is unnatural. And in the same way also the man abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire toward one another, men with men, committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. Now, Paul will use homosexuality, which is what he just did, as an example to portray the unnatural nature of sin. It is absolutely disgusting, right? But it's not just with the sin of homosexuality. We ought to look at sin that way. It's all sin. I mean, Paul's going to even go as far as saying, verse 32, that those who give approval of sin are worthy of the same condemnation as these people. Sin of any kind is wrong. It's unnatural. And from Genesis 3 and onward then, you see this cycle of sin. It keeps turning and turning. And it just seems to get worse as it goes along. And along with sin then, consequences have to follow because it's unnatural. And that which is unnatural will undoubtedly lead to greater and graver consequences. Now, if you're God, which we're not, but there is one, what do you do about all that, right? You created everything in the beginning. Everything was perfect. The greatest part of your creation disrupted the goodness. They brought sin into the world because they thought they were missing out on something, which they weren't. And now everything is turned into this hot mess. The Bible tells us that God is light. He is repeatedly held up to be the pinnacle of holiness. He is utterly holy and righteous. And where he is then, sin cannot be. That's why Adam and Eve had to leave that Garden of Eden. I mean, we look at that passage, God isn't being harsh on them. When we begin to understand the gravity of sin. I mean, we may even look back at that passage and say, God was pretty good for that, right? God was pretty good with them by just letting them leave the garden. But that's what sin does. It separates us from the goodness of God. And because of God's righteousness and his holiness, he judges and punishes those who sin. Sin I want to tell you today, I hope this isn't the first time anybody in here has ever heard this. But maybe somebody in the live stream or somebody that listens to this later could be the first time they're ever hearing this. Sin is a choice. It is a conscientious decision made to follow through on the unnatural, evil desires that come along. James 1, 13 to 15 would point that out. Sin is not natural. And if you hear people say we were born with sin, or we were made with the genetic makeup to sin, let them read James 1, 13 to 15. The Bible knows no such thing. And to even to begin to argue that we were created to sin, to me, would be an argument against the existence of God. Because that would make him a liar. As humans, no one has to tell us then that evil and wrong must be held accountable. If somebody breaks into your home, I'm sure you'll call the police. Now, you know what the funny part about that is? That's true for the atheist as well. Even the atheist, right? He says there's no absolute right or wrong. There's no absolute truth. There's no way we have a high standard of morality. But you break into that person's home, you'll be the first ones to dial 911. I need some justice. Wait a minute. On what basis do you need justice? You said there's no such thing as absolute truth, absolute right or wrong, and there's no morality. Why are you asking for justice? Right? The atheist will do that. And the problem is, he fails to recognize that he was created by a God that put that within us. We crave justice. We cry out for justice. We look at the television and we see these headlines about all the wrong that's being done in the world, whether it be political or societal or whatever the case might be, and we want justice. Nobody has to tell us that. You let a 5-year-old kid grow up till he's 15, you don't really have to teach them that. They will desire justice because God put that in us. And listen, we live in a world that's flawed. It's flawed. One of the favorite shows Sylvia and I like to watch is Dateline on NBC. And one of the reasons you get nervous as you're watching the show, right, is because there are bad people out there. And that's not really what makes you nervous. It's what is the verdict going to be about it? As you're watching, you think to yourself, this person should be off the street. Why on earth is this person still out there living in the world like a decent human being when he is a menace to society? And the verdict rests in the hands of 12 people who have to decide whether or not the evidence supports a guilty or non-guilty verdict, which sometimes it's flawed. It's a failure, right? There is no such thing as 100% justice in our court of law, is there? It's flawed. That's why a lot of people don't even want to go to court anymore, because they know they're probably going to lose. And that's precisely why there must be a hell. Because if there cannot be 100% justice on earth, you better believe there's going to be 100% justice on that side of eternity. There is a hell because God's love demands that. We're going to talk about that in a second, but hell is a place, the Bible tells us, that is prepared by God. And again, not surprisingly, it wasn't prepared for us because God did not put it within us to naturally seek a place called hell. He put it within us to seek him, eternity, heaven. But hell exists, Matthew 25, 41 tells us, because of the devil and his angels, his followers, his messengers. But go back to James 1 and we realize the devil is the tempter. He tempted Adam and Eve, right? They committed the sin. The devil tempts us now. The Bible tells us he's a roaring lion seeking whom he can devour. He is representative of everything that is unjust, unfair, and unnatural. about this world and experiences. And it is unfair to say to God and to look to God and to blame Him for all the unfair things in this world. It ain't God's fault. It's not Him. It's the devil and us and what we do, right? He tempts us. He gives us an offer that seems too good to refuse. We follow through with that offer. There's that choice, that conscientious decision. And all of a sudden, we got consequences piling up, creating this hot mess of a world that we now live in. And there's got to be some form of justice for all that. Surely, this world will not keep going on the way that it is with impunity. I don't think anybody accepts that, right? Because who would want to even have kids in a world like that? Who would even want to live any longer in a world like that? I'll tell you this, my generation, one of the questions of my generation has always been, should we even have kids? That's how bad the world is, right? And we don't want our kids to grow up in such a world. That demands justice. Would you not say so? And I believe the Bible teaches that hell is that form of justice. Because people sin and because people give in to the devil, they will end up there. I mean, you just can't go on and on with everything happening the way that it is. That would suggest God is a failure, that He is not all powerful, and He's not in control. But again, nothing could be further from the truth. He's going to bring it all to end in a place that is perfected to be incredibly painful and disgusting in every which way imaginable to the human mind. I want you to read with me Mark chapter 9, beginning in verse 43 this morning. Mark 9, beginning in verse 43. Now you read with me, or you heard me read that passage in Romans chapter 1. That unnatural, degrading passion, right? Men and men, women and women, all that. See how disgusting that is, right? I mean, a lot of people read verses like that and they want to go throw up. That should be a natural reaction because it's just disgusting. Now, take that imagery and apply it to what we're about to read. Mark 9:43. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life crippled than having your two hands go into hell, into the unquenchable fire where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. If your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life lame than having your two feet be cast into hell, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. If your eye causes you to sin, throw it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than having two eyes being cast into hell, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. Now listen, there was a place that was called Gehenna, right? This is the Greek word Gehenna. And it was this place that was associated with kind of a dump site. This disgusting looking, smelling, awful to the atmosphere, awful to your eyes dump site. The worms would crawl all around it. We may call those maggots, those terrifying little creatures that we want no part of, right? Once the trash begins to decompose. And some of those dump sites will set it on fire. And because you keep piling trash upon trash, the fire just seems to go on forever. That's the picture hell uses. But for eternity. Perfected for suffering. Would you not say that is justice for the evil that we see in this world? For the men and women who stand in opposition to God and preach that abortion is okay? That there is such a place called hell is very plausible. And the atheist will not ever give in to this idea, but even he himself, in his natural inclination, will one day recognize that this place is real. Hell is real precisely because of the pattern of sin that we just observed. Because it's so bad out there, and because it will always be so bad because sin exists, God needs to bring that to an end. I want you to think about that. God, we should look to God. And again, if you're God, man, you have to be, talk about patience and grace. God has put up with that for some time now. He can bring to an end any second he wants, but he has put up with that for some time now. What a great God we serve. I mean, that's the only thing I can think about when I think about the evil and the justice that needs to follow. And look, I can stand here this morning and give you all the evidence in the world that hell exists from a non-biblical standpoint and from a biblical standpoint. But ultimately, hell exists because of the evidence and our faith in that evidence. They're not separate and apart, they're together. So hell seems, by all standards here, to be true. And I don't think anybody will deny that based on that justice argument. That's why I used it, right? But number two, when talking about hell, does the reality of hell negate the love of God? I know some of you are already saying, no, it doesn't. I appreciate that. That's good. We're on the right track there. But this is a tough argument when somebody brings it up. It's just tough because emotions are what is usually involved here. And it's hard to argue with somebody that's emotionally involved, because you can't dissuade them, you can't persuade them from what they've already made up their minds to believe because they're emotionally involved. That's what it is. And so when one thinks about hell, often what's going to come to their mind is eternal punishment, right? We've established that. Mark chapter 9, Matthew 25, so on and so forth. This dark, miserable, painful, perfected to be disgusting place. And then we look at a God who is loving. He's held up to be loving in the biblical narrative. He is held up to be this God of love. 1 John chapter 4, God is love, right? And so they'll equate those two ideas. I'm not saying we do. I'm saying skeptics, unbelievers, atheists. They'll argue that if hell exists, then that means God cannot be loving. How can a loving God send people to a place of eternal punishment forever and ever? I mean, surely he would not even think of doing something like that. If God truly loves us, why would he prepare a place like that for people to suffer? Sounds like a major contradiction, and one that goes against the principles of God himself. But the argument is often made that there doesn't need to be a hell, right? So they're going to take that a step further. It's just not fathomable to the human mind, because we were not created that way. But the other aspect of that argument is we would be watering down God's love. If we would just say that God would just give us a pardon, right? I mean, we were born to sin anyway. You see how these arguments begin to shape up a watering down of God's love? If we accept that we were born to sin, then we have to accept that God's going to pardon us somehow. Not the cross. We're talking about doing anything we want and then still getting to heaven. So the cross would be meaningless, which means Jesus' death would be meaningless. Look, love is not a one-sided virtue. It never has been and it never will be. And this is what people do with God's love. They think about it as only what God concerns himself with that pertains to good and perfect, and that he's going to somehow turn a blind eye to all the evil and wrong and sweep it under the rug. Do we accept that out there? Absolutely not. Somebody commits murder, somebody's going to pay. Somebody gets robbed, somebody's going to pay. There's no sweeping anything under the rug out there. But we are supposed to accept that from God? There's something wrong with that argument. The reality of hell does not negate the love of God, because one of the most important aspects of love is discipline. But you know, the sad reality is some people have just heard that for the first time today. Nobody knows what discipline is anymore. None. And the Bible teaches that you cannot love someone properly unless discipline is involved. Love is never separated from justice and accountability. Never. Even in the Bible tells us that God disciplines those whom he loves. Hebrews 12, 4 to 11. And listen, I would argue that's exactly why the world is the way it is today. We don't know what love is anymore. We have twisted it. We've added our own definitions to it. And the reason we do that is we don't want conflict. We don't want hurt feelings. We don't want to hear our children cry. So we're not going to discipline. We've watered down with respect to God and respect to the society and family what love is. And if we do that, do we have any right to be surprised why the world is the way it is today? And it's these very people that are going to cry out for justice and accountability when they have separated discipline from love. If anything, hell means God is loving, precisely because of that justice. If God just let us do everything we wanted to do and there was all chaos and all division and all this nonsense that's out there, nobody was ever held accountable for it, would that be fair to us who are trying to live right and decent lives? I mean, we would have waited. Paul would put it this way: we are of all men most to be pitied. And we would be. Love isn't some rosy, sweet feeling that causes butterflies to float around in our stomachs. Love is about doing what is right and bringing into judgment those who have committed wrong, even if it's the most unpopular thing to do, and even if it's the hardest thing to do. If it's hard, chances are it's probably right. If it hurts, chances are it's probably right. Hell shows God is loving because injustice will be punished. Sin will have an end. And the devil is going to have to face the punishment he deserves. That's guaranteed. And if everyone was going to heaven, how fair would that be? I mean, that would indicate God doesn't love us because other people were rewarded for the sin they did just the same as we did for not doing any sin. But I think the bottom line is this. A lot of people that question hell and God's love are the same ones who are most fearful of the idea of ending up there. In my experience, I found that to be almost 98% true. The people that are arguing and asking about God's love and calling God's love into question are the very ones that are fearful of being in hell. But listen, if our lives is what God would have it to be, if our lives return to the standards of the Garden of Eden, and in this particular world, because of the cross of Christ and the grace that we've been blessed with, it returns to that standard, then I think we shouldn't have to worry about anything as far as hell is concerned. Because that's not where we're going to be. We're going to be in heaven. Hell is far in the back of the mind somewhere, right? Because it's unnatural, and we would like to keep it that way. But as long as we keep giving in to unnatural desires, we will end up in an unnatural place. But if we follow the natural plan of God, the way he made it all, we will end up in the right natural place he wanted us all to be, and that's heaven. I would even say the more and more we go closer to God, the more we begin to respect this idea of hell. Because that means there is justice for sin. There is justice for evil. And all of God's enemies and the enemies of the Christians throughout human history can rest assured that they will pay for what they've done. All the evidence, both in the Bible and in the world, points to the conclusion that hell does not negate the love of God. It just does not. If anything, hell shows God is loving. We can go on and on and on about this. By the way, some of you may be wondering, why isn't this being preached tonight, right? Our evidence is sermon. This isn't really an argument from evidence, but it kind of is. I had a hard time trying to decide whether or not I should preach it tonight, but I decided to preach it in the morning instead. You know, just there's more people here in the morning anyway, but I hope this sermon helps us to realize that sin is ugly. I mean, that's what we're supposed to get away from this sermon. Not that hell is real and oh, hell is bad. I mean, sure, that's a natural byproduct, but it's sin and how bad it is. Hell is real. It's just as real as heaven. It is a place of eternal suffering, the horrors and likes no man or creature has ever experienced. And you know what makes hell so bad? God isn't there. The creation is separated from his creator forever. And the reason people think that they can go on living in the world with impunity right now is because God is still existent around us in his creation. You take that all away, they will never come to that conclusion anymore. And one day they will, because that's what hell is, separated from God forever. But I want to tell you what we need to do. Jesus would say, enter through the narrow gate. For the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction. And there are many who enter through it. The gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life. There are few that find it. There's a very few number of people here today, and I find that fitting. Movie theaters are packed on Friday and Saturday nights. I mean, packed. But on Sunday mornings, the churches aren't packed. God isn't being honored. And that says something about where our priorities are. But if we, the few, desire to be faithful and just follow through with the natural, we have nothing to worry about. If you're here this morning and you're still living in the unnatural, based on what we talked about, I mean, what's stopping you from making a change? That there is nothing more devastating than the reality of being separated from God forever. And we ought to take that to heart and make changes where necessary. Jesus said, if your hand and your eye and your feet are going to cause you to sin, get rid of it. Make sacrifices that are hard. They're going to hurt, but they will pay off in the end. So if you need to do that this morning, to confess Jesus, to be baptized, repent of your sins, we would invite you to come while we stand, while we sing.